In medicine, most interventions have side effects. You want to do something about your cold? Okay, we have these little pills. If you take them, your nose might stop running, but there's also a chance you'll be very sleepy for a few hours and you probably shouldn't operate heavy machinery. Decide for yourself, right? A KU researcher thinks this is how we should talk about education. If there's a new approach to reading, for example, you might say, okay, this improves test scores, but then you'd also look at the bigger picture and ask, what else does it do, and is it worth it? I'm Gina Kaufman here with Yang Zhao, the author of What Works May Hurt, Side Effects in Education. Good morning, Yang.
Good morning, Gina.
So the idea here is that educational practices can help and hurt at the same time, just like medicine. Can you explain that a little more?
Yeah, I thought it was common sense. And, you know, it's very simple because there are different outcomes, for example, in education as in health. You know, it's a very complicated system that can be, you know, have positive effect on one outcome, but negative effect on another outcome that you mentioned just now about reading programs, for example. It might improve short-term test scores in reading, but could make your children hate reading forever. That's one example. And the same thing, you know, it's called, you know, in schools, when you do high-stakes testing on a few subjects and schools pour all the resources on reading and math, but then they ignore the larger picture, like the humanities, you know, sports and even recess, so which may have a negative impact on children's interest in school and engagement.
Well, so I want to know from our listeners if aspects of your education had unintended side effects, and if they did, call 816-235-2888 to tell us about that. You know, Professor Zhao, it seems like this was all inspired by No Child Left Behind, the Bush-era education policy. First of all, remind us of the main idea behind that policy.
Well, that was a while back, and several things, I think, in that law. One of them is to hold schools accountable, and by annual introducing testing and to our schools in really massive and using the test scores to judge a school's quality and improvement, something called AYP. So we saw a massive increase of testing of our children, but really in math and reading. So that was one thing. Another thing of that is called scientifically based. That was really interesting, called an evidence-based education, and trying to make, for example, reading more science-based. And so they tried to issue funding only to programs that have been proven to be working. And there was a $6 billion program called Reading First for really disadvantaged schools, in the hope that this scientific and proven methods would improve children reading from disadvantaged families. But in the end, a huge national evaluation says there was no effect. I think at the time, the then Secretary of Education, Margaret Spenny, was calling this like a cure for cancer. It would solve our problem in reading, but it did not happen. So it got me really to look into that to say, okay, what really happened? You know, for example, in some areas, they found tiny improvement in perhaps decoding, but then did not find improvement in reading comprehension. So that one was one of the ideas. And another idea was that, of course, the high-stakes testing put upon schools. Because I was born and raised in China, I saw the impact of test scores, testing systems. You say the Asian children, from China, Japan, and others, have always outperformed students in America in international testing. But at the same time, in these countries, a lot of the students have experienced high anxiety, a loss of interest, and lack of confidence in this area. So I said, this is interesting. And maybe the short-term gains look very impressive, but it could have serious long-term damages to our children. So I began to look into that. And so that's what really resulted in this book.
Yeah, I mean, how do you look into something like that?
Well, it's very tough because, as you know, in education, there was really no tradition of looking at both sides. But in essence, the effect is really of any approach, is like medicine, can be positive or negative, depending on your perspective. You know, so what you need to do in medicine, you know, as the FDA always requires, you know, medical medicine developers to report negative side effects. But in education, there was no such history. So I had to really go to, first of all, gather long-term data and compare systems, you know. So, for example, you look at, you know, U.S. has been looking at international studies. So whenever there's a big study report comes out, like the PISA, that's the Program for International Student Assessment, or TIMSS, that's called Trends in International Mathematics and Science Study. And we always talk about how America underperforms compared to other countries in terms of testing. But in these studies, they always have other surveys of students' feelings, students' self-reported confidence, for example, interest in subject. And they were seldom, I would say, never really made into the big news reports. So I examined those data, for example. I discovered in Asian countries, and they are always reporting that they're worried about their children, lack of confidence and loss of interest in the subjects. So you said there's negative correlations. That's one area you could look at that. And then again,
you're saying that's
at
a negative correlation with
reading first program.
Sorry, I just want to make sure I understand. You're saying a loss of confidence is a possible negative a side effect, basically, of the kind of rigorous testing.
Yes. That's so I was saying the called negative correlation between test scores and confidence, for example, meaning countries that produce high test scores seem to produce lower confidence students. And so that's where you could start looking by looking large scale data.
You know, you reference an old Chinese saying about drinking poison to quench thirst. And that seems to sort of frame some of this conversation about educational policies and their ability to address one very specific problem while being sort of holistically detrimental.
Yes. Well, Gina, that's one big problem in policy making, not only in policy making, really, it's also in education practices in schools and sometimes families, is that we're so eager to solve a short-term problem, and we find some education approaches or policies that seem to be effective in solving short-term, but in the long run, then we see actually problems, and that is the negative side effects. It's, and that's what the Chinese saying that, yes, it seems to quench the thirst in the short run, but in the long run, it doesn't work. And again, in my research, I find, for example, if you teach children too early using direct instruction, they may be able to master the knowledge you're trying to force them to memorize, but again, they might lose curiosity. That might stop them from being creative, or at least reduce creativity. That's another issue. So when we celebrate a very short-term memorization of something, you know, not again, an approach may be really effective, but at the same time, when you are transmitting the knowledge or the approach you're trying to give them, that make them memorize that, in the end, it makes learning so boring, and so children, again, lose confidence and lose interest.
So, and you have research that shows that the early introduction of something like reading, for example, that causes a loss of creativity and curiosity?
Yes, I've gathered, and that's not my own research. There's several studies showing that, for example, even four-year-olds, when you try to explicitly tell them how to play with a toy, a new toy, they would probably they would play with the toy much less time. They would not try to explore as many new functions as in other conditions when children simply are asked to explore. So there's a study showing that.
You know, I'm curious about how your own personal history, your own childhood and education, how those things shape your perspective on this.
Well, it's been interesting because I was, again, born, raised in China, and went to school in China, taught in China. Then I have been in the U.S., been teaching for over 20 years in colleges in various parts of the country in the U.S. And again, you know, Chinese system, education system, represents one end of the spectrum of education, and the U.S. represents the other. So when I, you know, look through the system, compare it, look at two systems to say, you know, both countries have been trying to admire each other's education. And I said, why is that? And it really turns out to be that we look at the positive end of the other system and ignoring the negative side of the other system. So that's really part of that. And of course, by my own education, I grew up in a tiny little village in China. And many people ask me, so how come like you are not like a Chinese education product? I said, well, you know, being asked is perhaps it's a side effect, but this one might be a positive side effect because I was born there during the Cultural Revolution and went to a school. There was very little resources, and my own parents were illiterate, yes, and so they were not able to force me into taking an education that was very Chinese. So I had more of a freer education. That's the side effects of probably a positive one in that sense, that is that they were not able to force me. And the school at that time was in disarray, and school system was not forcing me to that. So I was kind of allowed a more of a freer education than many other Chinese kids have enjoyed.
Are you getting a lot of pushback against this idea that, you know, that a policy sort of scientifically shown to address a problem, a specific problem in education, is still something that maybe you should question based on some other big picture kinds of concerns? Do you get pushback against that?
Funny enough, actually, I have not. It's really strange. But again, maybe this is it is so common sense that if you look at me in the U.S. right now, the testing is really interesting. Accountability, I mean, in Kansas, you know, we are adopting testing. Another thing, we're trying to adopt something called the Common Core to focus on two or three subjects. And this has resulted in serious damages in our system, I mean, Kansas City included. One of them is called narrowing the curriculum. When you try to spend all your resources, your time on two subjects, for example, and you are going to narrow the curriculum, and this is going to hurt our poor kids a lot more because their families, unlike their wealthier counterparts in the suburbs and who could buy extra lessons or opportunities in arts and music and other kind of things to expand their children's horizon. But for poor kids who are stuck in public schools that have narrowed the curriculum, and that they don't have that opportunity. And that's why, you know, in the U.S., even the policies we've been trying to do, No Child Left Behind, now the ESSA, really have not seen dramatic improvement in American education or narrowing the achievement gap, actually has widened that. So that's really a side effect that we should look at. You know, side effects occur, like in medicine, the same way in education for a number of reasons. One is, as we discussed, Gina, that is there are so many different outcomes, you know, short-term, long-term, cognitive outcomes versus non-cognitive outcomes. You know, cognitive, maybe you can perform certain tasks, but do you want to perform the task? You know, your children may be able to accomplish some testing, but do they want to do it? I think that's one thing. And so that's one. And also subjects, you know, if you want your children to be well-rounded, you might want to expose them to more subjects, but you know, that learning any subject takes time. And that time spent on math cannot be spent at the same time on music, for example. So we need to think about that. Another reason, as I was talking about, different medicine, we have different effects on different people. And we always advise, you know, if you are, some medicines are not good for pregnant women, and penicillin can be, you know, detrimental to people who are allergic to it. And so that's why some policies may benefit some population. It's a school choice or voucher systems, you know, could help people who could make the choice when the choices are available, when the parents are able to transfer the kids. But those may not be helpful at all to other families and who may not have those resources or conditions, and that can cause them detrimental impact.
Well, Yang Zhao, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Gina.
Yang is a professor at KU's School of Education, and his book is What Works May Hurt: Side Effects in Education. Up next on KCUR's Central Standard, civility. Do we need more of it in our political discourse, or does civility have its limits? 816-235-2888. We want your take. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today we are talking about civility and incivility in American politics, not just for the politicians out there and how they conduct themselves, though that is a big part of it, but for us, all of us, and how we engage with the news, with each other, with our representatives. Do we need civility more than ever, or are there situations where it makes sense to say, you know what, we're past that? 816-235-2888. My guest this morning is Don Heidermarkel from the KU Department of Political Science. Hi, Don.
Good morning, Gina.
So when we think about just the norms of what is and isn't considered civil in political discourse, have those norms been changing?
Well, I think you could make an argument that you could find historical periods where we've been just as incivil or uncivil to one another, whether it's our elites or amongst the masses. The Civil War would be a good example. The end of the Civil War, as well as leading up to it, even in the
Can
first.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, obviously, it is called a war for a reason. But what specifically are you thinking about?
Well, just the sort of personal attacks on one another, and even the violence that people were willing to engage in, everything from in the streets to in the halls of Congress. So oftentimes today we see pictures of some other parliament on the other side of the world where legislators are actually fist fighting in the parliament, and that seems so unusual to us. But there were times in our history when those things happened as well.
Well, in the Topeka Capitol, there is a painting of John Brown.
Yes, absolutely.
Talk to me about that. I mean, that is the symbol of our state politics on some level.
Right. And that sort of that early abolitionist period that led up to Bleeding Kansas and then, of course, to the Civil War, you can see examples, especially with the early stages of the abolitionist movement, acts of violence against those who spoke out against slavery, against the news media that tried to preach the abolitionist view in parts of the country where that wasn't so popular. People were willing to engage in violence against those who pursued an abolitionist path, those who tried to set up stations on the Underground Railroad and examples like that. And then, of course, in Kansas itself, as the battle over whether or not Kansas would be a free state or a slave state, the intervention in that process by Missouri ruffians as well as others, leading to actual violence on both sides in that debate.
So, I mean, yeah, looking back, it seems like there is not a shortage of examples of times when incivility has kind of been the rule of the day. We are, in fact, a nation with origins in revolution.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the difference today is that it's more common, and even over trivial issues, just the personal attacks against each other by elites, as well as just in common discourse from regular citizens.
Okay, so let's talk about that distinction between what the expectation is for quote unquote civility when it comes to people in elected office and the standards for civility when we're just, you know, talking amongst ourselves, just like you and me, you know?
Yeah, well, as a general rule, I mean, whether it be in sort of civil society or a formal debate and debate kinds of rules, to use kinds of ad hominem attacks or personal attacks against people as a means to establish your point or establish legitimacy for your point is just seen as a flawed exercise in a simple way. And therefore, you know, the notion that the discussion is occurring because you want to convince somebody else of your ideas, attacking people personally is not an effective way to do that. So, and in a democracy, since we have to have some majority come to an agreement about and compromise about their points of view, trying to convince others through acts of incivility seems to break down the tenets of democracy. And in that way, you would simply argue, whether it's, like I say, debate rules or how democracy functions, this is just an ineffective way to convince people of your point of view.
How would you define civility? I mean, just how do you define that word?
So I would say it could be defined several different ways, but for me, it is basically the notion that you are not engaging in personal attacks against people as a means to pursue your point of view. But that includes the kinds of language that you would use about other people, but even about other people's ideas. Disparaging language and certainly foul language would be the kinds of things that would be examples.
So though, like, okay, so as long as you are not using personal attacks, confrontation in and of itself is not uncivil. Like, people have a lot of different takes on, for example, that restaurant owner refusing service to Sarah Huckabee Sanders because they couldn't support the policies she had spent her day defending. Is that incivility?
So, you know, that's a little bit different because it's a business owner and people might have different views about the roles and responsibility of a business owner and how they treat their customers. You know, typically most businesses have an option of being able to refuse service under certain conditions. So to define that as uncivil, I don't think is easy as it might look to some people. It you know, whether I define that as civil or not tends to be on my political perspective and not what I actually think of the act. In many ways, I would say basically because she had talked to her employees and asked her employees about whether or not they were willing to serve this person and could they essentially deliver this customer the service that a customer deserves, it seemed as though they couldn't. And therefore, there was no point to trying to complete that service.
Is that inability in and of itself like a symptom of a breakdown in civility, or is that something else? I mean, it's interesting because, you know, like, people are comparing that to, say, the refusal of a baker to provide a cake to a same-sex couple based on their political or religious perspectives on same-sex marriage. I mean, is there a difference between refusing service to a protected class based on race, religion, sexual orientation, and refusing service based on someone's political actions?
Yeah, I think on one level you'd have to make a distinction between somebody asking somebody to do something on a basis of their religious views versus their political views. At the same time, one could argue, I mean, what they were protesting in the restaurant case was essentially the fact that that the administration was taking refugee and potential immigrant children away from their parents, that was seen as an act that was violating people's human rights and was morally incorrect. So you could find an argument there as well that would be similar to religious beliefs or at least secular beliefs as well. But nevertheless, I would say, you know, again, going back to the idea that this is functioning as a business, if a business can't deliver services the way it thinks it should deliver services to its customers, there's not really much point in trying to make that delivery. See what I mean? So the fact that her employees weren't willing to do that, I think, led to that decision. Now, whether or not her employees themselves were being uncivil, I think you could make the case. But the restaurant owner, I don't think was being uncivil. I think that possibly the employees were.
It seems like from their standpoint, I mean, what you're describing about the human rights violation, their view that the separation of families at the border was a human rights violation, from their standpoint, would the policy that they're objecting to be the act of incivility?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's the way a lot of people sort of see that policy of separating parents and their children as being simply violating basic tenets of what we believe, how we should treat other human beings. This is clearly a dramatic and traumatic act that's being done to achieve a political objective, and therefore should really sort of violate our basic sense of decency and norms. I think that's the way plenty of people see that action. Others see that as the only means left, or one of the only means left to try to reduce the desire for people to enter the United States from other countries.
So, stepping back to this question, this bigger question about civility, make the case for civility. What is the value of civility?
Well, I come back to the notion that, it's really hard to point to examples of someone that was able to convince somebody else of their point of view by being uncivil or incivil. And therefore, if the real goal of communication, if my real goal in speaking is to try to convince you of something, or at least shift your perspective away from where it currently is, engaging in incivility is not going to do that in an effective way.
So the biggest danger of incivility is just that it's ineffective?
Well, it's ineffective, but if you're going back to the notion of in a democracy where sort of deliberation, discussion, and compromise are how the government is supposed to function, if we're not able to at least convince others, at least of part of what we want to say, compromise won't be possible. And therefore, democracy, the way democracy works, begins to break down. So, I mean, you can see in the sense of the U.S. Congress and even in some state legislatures today, where incivility is high, distrust is high, et cetera, they're able to get very little done. Even in a body that has a majority control of one party, incivility across parties, incivility within parties, is breaking down the ability to even allow government to function.
What?
And that, I think, should be a concern to everybody.
Can you give some specific examples of that?
Of incivility in Congress?
Of incivility leading to government bodies incapable of getting things done. I mean, I think we can all think of our own examples, but I'd like to just hear some specifics.
Well, I think to look at the immigration debate in Congress is a good example, and the recent attempts by members of the Republican Party in the House to try to force some action, at least in the case of Dreamers, some action in the House and force the leadership to act, with, a good proportion of Democrats going along, some Republicans going along. They were basically having to hold the leadership's feet to the fire. They couldn't find a way to compromise on this issue because there's distrust across the parties and a certain level of distrust and incivility, even within the Republican Party over this particular issue. They can't seem to find a way forward, and therefore problems don't get solved.
Is there a different standard, though, for what's happening within the ranks of government and what's happening among the rest of us? I mean, I guess, is it a privileged position to say to everyone out there, take it to the ballot box in November? There are some things that arguably are affecting people in such an immediate way that 4 months from now is an awfully long time to wait to cast that ballot.
Oh, I think that's true. But I mean, like I say, certainly there are actions people can take and people can engage in protest activity and make their voices heard. But the ways of doing that that are seen as acceptable in a democratic society don't include actual harassment of people, or, for example, let's say I just wanted to write an op-ed for a newspaper. I think the effective way of communicating there is not to personally attack the people I disagree with, but to take apart their arguments in a civil manner. If those, there are actions that can be taken, but telling people you know where they live and threatening people, I don't think is going to convince people to change their point of view. It might even just solidify their point of view.
Let's talk to Alan, who has called us at 816-235-2888 to weigh in on this issue about the role of civility in political discourse. Alan in Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Okay, it's Al. And truthfully, I'm having real problems with this discussion. You know, in political discourse, there have been many successes due to not being civil, i.e. the end of the Vietnam War. Diplomacy is different than political discourse. Political discourse is a charged, by definition, dialogue. This kind of feigned piety and good manners doesn't really fly in the face of good political discourse. And I don't know, I mean, I don't want to make a personal attack here, but I don't know what Sunday school this guy just stepped out of, but it is not a valid discussion to think that by being nice, somehow you will win the political argument.
So Al, I want to jump in and ask you something. It sounds like the end of the Vietnam War maybe is something that you have some strong feelings about and connections to, maybe memory of. I'm interested in how you saw an example or maybe experienced some example of incivility or what you would characterize as incivility having its place.
Characterize as what? Civility, did you say?
That you were saying that the Vietnam War maybe wouldn't have ended if not for incivility. And I'm wondering, first of all,
correct,
what you're characterizing as incivility. And then second of all, how do you think that was effective?
Direct, very outspoken confrontation with the power structure. Because the power structure will always exercise its power if given an opening. We have a situation right now that is very similar to this. People have to speak up in order to take control of their destiny. So it's not just the Vietnam War. I mean, there are many examples of this where confrontation brings results. And this idea of being soft-spoken and nice and polite and civil is one thing, and there is a place for that in diplomacy, because diplomacy is an art, it's a craft, and it's handled through a very complex system of etiquette. That is not political discourse. Political discourse is confrontational, it's direct, it is challenging, and it really is a competition. So
if I could
jump in, Don.
If I could just jump in, from what you're saying there, I wouldn't disagree. I would say what you're talking about, though, is confrontational and charged is not the same thing as uncivil. So, again, having protests about, I would tend to disagree. I don't think that having protests in the street is an uncivil thing. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's
the difference between violence in the streets, between, say, what the Weather Underground did versus what others did to protest the Vietnam War. Is there's a reason we call that civil disobedience versus violence, political violence.
Yeah,
so
Kent State was a very interesting example, wasn't it? You know, where kids were, you know, peacefully demonstrating, making a lot of noise, very, outspoken, but were killed. So, you know, I'm sorry, I get what you're saying, but I also get that you may not have ever been in a confrontational demonstration based on what you're saying. So, you know, civil, I don't understand. Maybe we need to define this word civil.
Yeah, I think let's spend a little more time on that. Al, for you, what would be your definition of civility versus incivility?
Well, I think the minute you start an actual personal attack rather than dealing with the issues, you get into a problem, because then everyone holds their ground and doesn't move. So something that I don't see anything wrong with criticizing someone and even being brutal about it, i.e. our current president. Yeah, it's okay to be brutal about him because you don't like him, and there's a reason for that. But if you're entering a discussion about his policies, that can be very vigorous and should lead to a dialogue. It doesn't have to be nice. It does not have to be nice. If you're attacking Donald Trump, you're missing the whole point. The point is his policies. So let's get into a dialogue. But it doesn't have to be a nice dialogue. It can be, look, you're wrong. You're an idiot. This is what's really happening. So civility has you're right. It needs to be defined. What are the limits of civility? I think good manners don't apply to political discourse.
So manners are different from civility, but actually, I mean, I am pretty surprised in a way to hear that Al's definition of civility, Don, is very similar to yours.
I would agree. I mean, I think a lot of it does have to do with the personal attacks, and in part underlying beliefs about other people are below that I think that's exactly right. So if I want to talk about the Trump administration or the president as a person, you know, I might take different approaches to that, but to simply use the notion of attacking a person's character as a means to challenge policies or actions by the administration, I think is just simply ineffective and uncivil. No matter what I think of that person as a person, I just don't think it's an effective way to move forward or convince others of my point of view.
Is there ever, I mean, I'm not talking about whether there is now, but is there ever such a thing as a situation just so egregious, something is happening that is so horrific that it does, in your mind, justify incivility?
Hypothetically, I could imagine situations that aren't about where an individual action is needed to end something that's, you know, directly in front of me. But the notion that I have to engage in a certain level of incivility or even engage in violence because of something that's happening far away from me, it just doesn't seem to me like an effective way to end what I'm trying to end. I mean, I look at it with the Vietnam War or other long-term protests. In many ways, I can look to moments in those protests where people were willing to engage in violence and uncivil actions, but the vast majority of it was civil, just like most of the Black Civil Rights Movement was civil, in that the kinds of civil disobedience they were engaged in was precisely for the point of convincing others of, you know, their point of view of what they're of pursuing their agenda, and the actions of others engaged against them is help what tipped the tide in favor of their point of view.
But can we just, that's interesting. Can you address what made civil disobedience, what makes civil disobedience civil? Because, yeah, it's.
Well, I think that's part of it, is that you're, in this case, you're engaged in a kind of political activity that is either illegal or in a particular jurisdiction or frowned upon
or highly disruptive. I mean, you're getting in people's way.
Right. But do so in a way that's not directly confrontational, not physically confrontational to people, or verbally confrontational to people. I think that kind of activity, certainly some people could see as uncivil because you're being disruptive. You're not following the rules. But at the same time, I would say that's precisely the civil disobedience, to say, I know I'm disrupting rules, but at the same time, I'm doing so in a way that's not threatening.
We're going to get right back to this discussion, 816-235-2888, to weigh in on this question of the role of civility, the limits of civility, whether there's ever a time when incivility is justified. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we are talking about civility in political discourse, whether it's eroding right now in a dangerous way, or whether there are limits to what civility can accomplish and how you know when you've reached that limit. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. I'm talking with Don Heidermarkel from KU's Political Science Department. Hi, Don.
Hi, Gina.
So something that we have not really talked about is just, you know, within the overall population, you have talked a lot about the dangers of the ranks of government losing their civility. What do you see as the sort of kind of worst case scenario, and maybe even symptoms of that already being here, of us having a breakdown in our civil discourse amongst ourselves as citizens?
Well, I think you probably people have seen examples of this maybe within their own families, but also in their use of social media going forward. I have, for example, friends I disagree with politically, and I'm able to continue friendships with them and communicate with them in particular ways, and I'm cautious about it. But I realize for most people, what's happening is they're shutting out those people, that they're shutting themselves off from people that they disagree with, and expanding their own sort of echo chamber, whether it be in their daily interactions or their social media use or whatever. They're shutting those people who disagree with them out, and partly as a way to avoid being uncivil. They're just sort of shutting them out and not wanting to engage then. And that, I think, basically harms all of us in the sense that we're not open to other people's perspective or understanding how they came to that perspective. And that really is harmful overall in thinking about how we move forward following an election, whether it be a local election or a presidential election. People we disagree with, how do we basically say, okay, we can move forward, we can find issues we agree upon, we're all human beings kind of situation. If we keep creating these narrow echo chambers, I just don't see how we really function as a broad society.
Let's talk with Kurt calling us from Olathe. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How about you?
I'm well, thank you. My point is this. I'll give you a specific example. There was a fellow that I know quite well and have for many years that decided that he didn't agree with the politics of the day. He was very anti-Trump, et cetera. And he had a tirade on Facebook and social media about anybody who would be stupid enough to vote for the man was an idiot, and kind of chiming in with Hillary's deplorables and so forth. And I don't see that accomplishes anything. It alienates people. It flies in the face of the topic we're talking about today, civility. And I do go to Sunday school and church, and I was taught that you treat others as you would like to be treated. And I think you can disagree with someone without disparaging them or belittling them or insulting them, i.e. Robert De Niro. I think that if you want to change someone's mind, you can do it in a thoughtful way that will give your point of view without belittling or demeaning the person that you're trying to have a discord with.
Hey, Kurt, I have a question for you. Would you mm-hmm. So it sounds like, you wouldn't want name calling. You wouldn't, you know, none of that. What about just making someone uncomfortable? Is that uncivil, or is it just, life?
I think that if it's a big topic, and someone is passionate about that topic, you're bound to make people uncomfortable. Because you disagree with them, and you can disagree with them fundamentally on any number of areas, but you don't have to raise your voice or swear or insult the other person to make your point known.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Kurt.
Mm-hmm.
Don, thoughts about this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I'd agree with that perspective. I think it's to the point of, exactly you know, what are you really trying to accomplish? If your goal is to end a particular policy, if your goal is to change the direction of an agency or whatever it might be, you know, incivility is engaging in personal attacks in the kinds of ways we're defining incivility is just not going to be effective. And in fact, tends to harden positions. And there's research that sort of backs this up, even with the perspective of like whether or not somebody's willing to recycle. You know, if I preach at somebody in a particular way and basically say, if you don't do this, you're a bad person, people tend to dig in their heels versus finding other ways of presenting the same idea to convince people to engage in that and what we see as a positive behavior.
Let's talk to Kim in Overland Park. Hi, Kim.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I just wanted to make two comments. You know, one is back to the issue of that I think your guest, or not your guest, yeah, the caller from KU was commenting about the inability to really be able to listen to other people's opinions as a way of expanding your knowledge about something. And that can get vigorous. It can get, you know, maybe impolite at times. It can get, as someone said, brutal. But I don't necessarily think that's uncivil. And I think that we're naive if we don't think some of what goes on in Congress is only about the issue. You know, it's about all sorts of other things besides the issue, relative to voters, relative to lobbyists, relative to people who've been in Congress so long that they, you know, are kind of out of touch with what really happens in the world. So I think that to kind of ability, while important, is kind of blocking out other very nuanced and concrete, you know, issues that can complicate making it that simple. So that's just one comment I'd like to make there. The other one, you know, you had asked, is there a situation so egregious that it, you know, kind of all bets are off?
Yeah.
And I think that the answer was only partial, because certainly there are. You know, it may not have been the Vietnam War. I was a Vietnam War protester. But, you know, when you look at more broad global issues, sure, there's a lot. You know, whether it might be Nazi Germany, it might be, you know, genocide in some of the countries over, you know, under Saddam Hussein's rule. So, you know, I think we need to be very precise in identifying the context in which we're discussing this topic. So that's all I have to say.
Well, Kim, thank you. I mean, Kim brings up parts of global history that, yeah, I think does I want to readdress that issue of how you know where you're in one of those situations, Don.
Well, that's a tough one to know. It's sort of like the frog in the slowly boiling pot, right? It's sort of like, is the temperature actually going up, or is the temperature going up so slowly that I can't really tell the difference between 1 minute and next? And I think that's a perfectly, you know, legitimate way to approach it. It's the question is, I think in the end, if I want to pursue change and I want to pursue pursue policy change or change the direction of a country or some jurisdiction, what's the best means for doing so? And I think simply attacking your opponents personally and engaging in other kinds of uncivil actions is just simply not effective. I mean, one of the perspectives I come at this from two perspectives. One is that, as an educator, I try to teach my students critical thinking. And to me, I define that simply as being able to hold two conflicting ideas in your mind simultaneously. And the best way to learn how to do that is to hear different perspectives. And second, I approach it from a perspective of political extremism and political violence. And the solution to changing what a government is doing by engaging in violence on one end of the spectrum is seen by many people as legitimate given the actions of the government. And I can't offer legitimacy to that. So if I move away from that and come to less extreme forms of engagement to try to change what a government is doing, I have to draw a line somewhere, and say, well, okay, clearly it's not okay to harm people or destroy property in the name of this. Where do I draw the line? And that's where I come up with the idea of personally attacking or threatening others as a way to achieve my goal, simply as a line I can't cross.
Do you think that part of the issue right now is that people are labeling things as incivility that are just bold, outspoken, disruptive?
There's part of that, but there's also, I think it's in line with this notion of political correctness and whether or not we can make people feel uncomfortable. And I think certainly we can make people feel uncomfortable. There's no means that you can't do that, but threatening people or personally attacking people is more than just making people uncomfortable.
Well, our time is up. Don Heider-Markle, thanks so much for anchoring this conversation about civility in American politics. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Gina.
You can catch whatever you might have missed from this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. And you can keep talking about this on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. I'm at Gina KCUR. Tomorrow, how Swope Park has changed over the decades, or maybe how Kansas City's changed around it. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Central Standard. Today's show was produced by intern Trevor Hook with help from Coy Duggar. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.